Right now, the US housing market is essentially pacing the halls of a high-security psychiatric ward, wearing a paper hospital gown, and it's utterly convinced that a 5.98% mortgage rate means it's ready to run a marathon.
Yeah, I mean, it is a truly remarkable level of clinical delusion. You look at the market's vitals, and it's pointing to a metric that historically signaled a severe cardiac event, and somehow it's interpreting that as the absolute picture of health.
It's exhausting to watch. So for today's deep dive, we're looking at the 2026 State of the Union real estate landscape. And to translate the sheer chaos of what is actually happening on the ground, we're pulling notes directly from a diagnostic chart compiled by Priyanshu or Pri Atathakar.
Right.
He's a commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor. And frankly, reading his analysis, it feels like finding the only reality-grounded clinician left in a ward of just recurring, widespread delusions.
Yeah, it's pre-notes in the patient's chart. Pretty much the rest of the industry is busy, projecting fantasy numbers on their spreadsheets. They are desperately trying to wish a recovery into existence.
Yeah, drawing smiley faces on the EKG monitor.
Basically, yeah. Pri is essentially the lead investigator here. He is the only one actually putting on the gloves and performing the autopsy on these failed deals while everyone else is polishing pro formas.
So our mission today is to decode Cree's deeply cynical, very clinical metaphors. We want to uncover the brutal mathematical truths about this market that the rest of the industry is just too sedated to mention.
Sedated is the perfect word for it.
Right. So let's start with the primary diagnosis. Before we talk about how you can protect your own portfolio, we have to understand the specific cognitive decline we are dealing with. So pre-diagnoses the market with affordability and anosognosia.
Yes.
I want to break down the actual mechanics of that medical term because it is doing a lot of heavy lifting in his report.
It really is. So anosognosia is this fascinating but terrifying neurological condition. It occurs when actual damage to the brain, usually the right hemisphere, creates a physical inability for a patient to recognize their own illness.
So it's not just psychological denial, like someone refusing to admit they have a cough.
No, not at all. It is not stubbornness. Their brain literally lacks the structural capacity to process that they are paralyzed or sick or, dying.
Wow.
And Pries applies this directly to the housing market to explain our current state of high-functioning delirium. I mean, the market's underlying housing costs are bleeding out a trauma unit, but the market's brain simply cannot process the deficit.
It genuinely believes it has never felt better.
Exactly.
And the trigger for this specific hallucination is that mortgage rates just dipped below 6%. They hit 5.98%, which the industry is breathlessly celebrating as this like monumental 3.5-year low.
Right, and pre-charts this symptom as selective memory recovery. The market is throwing a parade for a 5.98% rate, completely omitting the fact that during the golden age of real estate.
You mean that 2010s era of zero interest rate policy they're always crying about?
Yes, that exact era. Back then, a 6% rate wasn't a victory. It was a massive red flag.
It was the cardiac event.
Right. It was the absolute ceiling of affordability. It was a warning sign that the market was overheating, and now they're popping champagne over it.
I'm trying to map out the economic logic the market is using to justify the celebration here. Priya mentions this thing called the short-term gap. So the patient is clinging to this isolated data point, right? The annual cost of carrying a new mortgage has mechanically dropped by about $5,000 compared to the recent peak.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, 5 grand in savings is a tangible relief for a buyer. Why does Prey view this as a symptom of cognitive decline rather than a genuine recovery?
Well, because the patient is hyperfixating on a really minor drop in their fever while totally ignoring the systemic infection.
Right.
Yes, the annual cost of the debt drops slightly, but the principal cost, the actual median home price, refuses to correct. Sellers are just stubbornly gripping on to peak golden age valuation.
They won't let go.
They won't. They are utterly disconnected from the reality of the current cost of capital. You cannot celebrate a slight reduction in debt service costs when the principal asset requires taking on a historic, crippling amount of debt in the first place. The math just breaks.
Right. It's like a patient finding the fountain of youth in a muddy puddle in the hospital parking lot.
Exactly.
But the delusion clearly isn't confined to, individual sellers holding out for peak pricing on some suburban cul-de-sac. This clinical disorientation has mutated.
Oh, heavily.
It is infecting macroeconomic federal policy, and it's creating these impossible logic loops. Let's look at the administration's 2026 State of the Union proposal.
The Grand Treatment Plan.
Right. The Grand Treatment Plan for the housing crisis is a ban on institutional investors.
Yeah. And Pry's boots on the ground diagnosis of this specific delusion is what he calls a retracing failure.
Okay. Walk me through that.
Let's walk through the actual mechanics of how real estate development functions versus how the government thinks it functions. The administration's stated goal is to increase housing supply, right? They want 4.3 million new homes built.
Which is a massive number.
Huge. And their proposed method to achieve this is to ban institutional investors, you know, the massive private equity funds and Wall Street entities, from buying single-family homes.
Because the political narrative is really simple. Institutions are buying up the limited supply, so if we ban them, those homes just magically become available and affordable for regular families.
Right, that's the narrative. But if we look at the life cycle of large-scale development, like a massive build-to-rent community, that narrative completely collapses.
Because of the funding mechanism.
Completely. Mm-hmm. Institutional capital is the engine that funds the creation of that supply in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
A regional developer doesn't just have, you know, $500 million in cash sitting around to acquire land, secure zoning, lay horizontal infrastructure, and then build 500 homes.
Right. They need backing.
They rely on the absolute assurance that once the project is stabilized, an institutional buyer will step in and purchase the entire community. That is their exit strategy.
So if you legally ban the institution from buying the asset upon completion?
The developer doesn't just build the homes out of the goodness of their heart. They're not a charity. They pack up their capital and they pivot to industrial warehouses or data centers.
So you are literally attempting to incentivize developers to build by outlawing their most reliable, well-funded buyers.
Yes.
Removing demand does not organically generate new supply. It just paralyzes the builders.
It's a complete logical short circuit, believing that removing the buyer will incentivize the seller to produce more.
I do want to push back on the boundaries of this policy logic, though, because another major federal move recently happened.
Right.
The Supreme Court just struck down the emergency tariffs on home builders. Mechanically, the trade barriers on Canadian lumber and foreign steel are gone. The tourniquet has been removed. So why does Pry's chart show that construction costs are still behaving like they're in the ICU?
Because that assumes the market operates on simple, immediate switches. You know,
yeah.
Tariff goes away, house becomes cheap tomorrow.
Right, the magic wand.
Exactly. That is another symptom of impaired reasoning. The damage from those tariffs was systemic. When you disrupt a global supply chain for years, mills shut down. Logistics routes are reassigned. Skilled labor just leaves the sector entirely.
They find other jobs.
Yeah. And you cannot instantly rebuild that infrastructure just because a legal ruling came down in Washington. Furthermore, inflation is incredibly sticky.
Oh, yeah.
If a material supplier realizes the market can technically bear, say, a 40% markup on drywall, they rarely lower their prices back to baseline just because their own import costs dropped. The margin just shifts to their bottom line.
Right. They just pocket the difference. And when federal logic breaks down at that macro level, the daily operations on the ground turn into a total administrative nightmare. Let's examine what Pry categorizes as operational friction hitting the multifamily and residential sectors.
This is where it gets really painful to watch.
Yeah, he points to a massive logistics breakdown where routine portfolio exits are just becoming impossible. He specifically references owners getting trapped in what he calls digital vaults.
Let's unpack the actual mechanical process a portfolio owner is getting dragged through right now.
Right. So a digital vault is Pry's clinical term for a bureaucratic quarantine.
Huh?
Under the new 2026 executive orders, we have these first look policies.
Okay.
The government has basically painted institutional capital as the villain, so they mandate that before an owner can sell a large multifamily asset to another private entity, they must offer it first to nonprofits or community land trusts or tenant unions.
Which, you know, sounds very noble on a campaign podium, but how does that actually function when, say, a $50 million bridge loan is maturing next week? It functions like molasses. The owner is locked in this digital vault, submitting to endless cycles of citizenship verifications, occupancy audits, and compliance reviews just to prove they gave the nonprofits a fair shot.
While the clock is ticking.
The liquidity is completely paralyzed.
Hmm.
And the reality is the nonprofits rarely have the capital to actually execute a $50 million acquisition anyway. So the property just sits there in administrative limbo while the owner's debt clock keeps ticking loudly in the background.
Which explains the destruction of what Pri calls the midnight ledger.
Yes.
Because before this regulatory quarantine, veteran investors relied on a very different circulatory system to get deals done.
They did. The midnight ledger was the network of off-market institutional handshake deals. It was how quiet, efficient capital deployment happened between trusted entities who actually knew how to navigate market cycles.
But if the government mandates that every single transaction has to pass through a public, highly scrutinized, nonprofit first portal, that ledger is rendered useless. The federal government is effectively threatening to seize the ink you'd use to write the ledger.
Precisely. And this regulatory friction is severely exacerbating the disorientation of individual sellers. Correa highlights a really bizarre contradictory symptom on the ground right now.
Drifting, right?
Yes, the drifting. So there is currently a 6% surge in sellers entering the market. Activity is supposedly rebounding. But he notes these sellers are experiencing severe drifting during negotiations.
Meaning they are completely untethered from mathematical reality.
Completely. They come to the negotiating table demanding 2021 peak market valuations for their property. But simultaneously, because of all the political rhetoric they've absorbed, they expect the buyer to magically secure a 3.5% interest rate to fund the purchase.
It's madness. They want a 2021 selling price funded by a 2020 interest rate, occurring in the reality of 2026.
Yeah, it demonstrates a total breakdown in market psychology. Sellers have anchored their financial identity to an artificial peak. Any reduction in their asking price isn't processed as a necessary market correction. It is processed as a personal theft of their wealth. Pri classifies this as decreased soundness in judgment.
So they're suffering from a financial hallucination where they believe the market can accommodate mutually exclusive realities.
Exactly.
They actually believe the market can keep their home values at record exclusionary highs while simultaneously making those same homes broadly affordable for working class buyers.
Which is mathematically impossible.
Right. Mathematically scarce, hypervalued assets cannot also be cheap and universally accessible. It's like a homeowner meticulously redecorating their living room while completely ignoring the fact that the roof is actively caving in on them.
That's a perfect analogy. Pri anchors this symptom to a severe lack of spatial awareness.
Okay, spatial awareness.
The market is entirely fixated on the floor. They are staring at the Federal Reserve's baseline interest rates, desperately waiting for that 3% mirage to materialize again. But because they refuse to look up, they are entirely ignoring the collapsing ceiling directly above their heads.
Let's connect the mechanics of that floor and ceiling. Because in Pri's chart, the heavy ceiling is the swelling government deficit, which has now reached, what, $700
billion? $700
billion,
yes.
And the average investor hears national deficit and thinks of abstract macroeconomics, right? They don't think about their specific commercial mortgage rate. So how does the ceiling physically prevent the floor from dropping?
It is a direct, unavoidable causality. When the federal government runs a $700 billion deficit, they must borrow capital to cover the shortfall.
Right. They have to get the money from somewhere.
And they do this by issuing treasury bonds. Now, to entice global investors to buy that massive, unprecedented flood of new bonds, the government has to offer a higher yield, a higher interest rate.
Okay.
Now, commercial and residential mortgage rates do not exist in a vacuum. They are fundamentally tethered to the 10-year treasury yield.
Because the treasury yield is essentially the structural support beam for the entire debt market.
Yes, exactly. If the government is offering high yields to fund its deficit, banks and private lenders must charge even higher yields on real estate mortgages to compensate for the added risk and to compete for that capital.
So the federal government is literally crowding the private borrower out of the debt market.
They are. The $700 billion deficit is the mathematical ceiling. As long as the government is demanding that much capital, borrowing costs for real estate simply cannot organically drop.
So the patient keeps checking their pulse, wondering why their blood pressure won't drop, completely ignoring the 50-pound iron weight resting on their chest.
Right. It's just basic physics at that point.
So if the entire commercial real estate sector is wandering this ward, having these financial hallucinations and demanding impossible math, how do you protect a portfolio from catching the contagion?
This is where Pri shifts his notes. From a clinical diagnosis to a defensive treatment plan.
We need a treatment plan.
Desperately. And it relies heavily on reverse psychology. In an environment where the consensus is this delusional, sanity requires a strictly contrarian, highly defensive posture.
Okay, so step one of Pri's treatment plan is establishing succession trigger points, which is basically about aggressively monitoring the cognitive state of the people managing your capital.
Exactly. You have to listen very closely to the specific vocabulary your general partners are using. Pri advises that if a GP starts justifying acquisitions based on, quote, vibes-based valuation,
Oh my God, which should instantly trigger
it
alarms.
should be a klaxon.
If anyone handling millions of dollars in capital uses the word vibes to justify a cap rate, the conversation is over. You're done.
Exactly. Or even more insidiously, if they start relying on Golden Age pro formas.
What does that look like in practice?
Well, a pro forma is the foundational spreadsheet that forecasts a property's future cash flow, expenses, and eventual exit value. If a GP builds that forecast, assuming we will inevitably return to a 0% interest rate environment to save the deal in year five,
Then they're actively hallucinating.
they are. You must trigger a transition and remove your capital immediately. You cannot allow a manager experiencing cognitive decline to fly the plane.
Right. And step two is implementing what Pri calls the fiduciary guardrail. This is a brutal reality-based stress test for any new acquisition.
It is the reality-based rate test. When underwriting a multifamily deal today, you must stress test the eventual refinance or exit, assuming a 6.5% interest rate environment.
Even if the State of the Union address is up there promising a sweeping return to affordability and a 3% rate.
Especially then, you underwrite the deal based on the crushing weight of the Treasury ceiling, not the political promises of an imaginary floor. If the math on your apartment complex collapses at a 6.5% refinance rate, you walk away. You let another, more delusional investor catch the falling knife.
Let them be the patient.
Exactly.
Okay, finally, treatment step three. Legal and estate integration. This directly addresses the fallout of the institutional investor ban we discussed earlier.
Right. This is about recognizing how Pri saw the symptoms before the family portfolio was traded away.
Yeah.
If you hold a large commercial or residential portfolio, your traditional, most lucrative exit strategy was likely selling to a REIT, a real estate investment trust.
Sure.
REITs pool massive amounts of capital to acquire stabilized assets. If federal legislation effectively outlaws those entities from buying your asset class, your primary avenue for liquidity is destroyed overnight.
So you are left holding a highly valuable asset that is suddenly totally illiquid, all because the government padlocked the main doors of the ward.
Yes. And Pri advises that your successor trustee must be legally and structurally prepared for this exact scenario today. You cannot wait for the legislation to pass.
It's triage.
It is triage. You must establish alternative liquidity routes right now, whether that means setting up structures for fractionalization, preparing for syndication spin-offs, or just aggressively diversifying into asset classes that aren't currently in the political crosshairs.
To synthesize Priyanshu Adithakur's clinical bottom line here, housing affordability is not fixed just because the bleeding temporarily slowed to a 5.98% rate.
No.
The greatest transactional risk in the 2026 market isn't the interest rate itself. The terminal disease is the delusion of a leadership team, both in the federal government and in corporate real estate, that genuinely believes they can legislate away the mathematical laws of supply and demand.
It is the absolute refusal to look at the actual brain of the deal.
Yep.
Pri is basically standing at the nurse's station, holding the clinical data, trying to explain to everyone that the inflated internal rate of return painted on the pro forma is a symptom of the disease, not a cure.
Which brings us to Pri's final brutal disclaimer at the very end of his diagnostic report. He notes that while his chart is framed as satire, the underlying math is deadly serious.
Very serious.
He states that if you truly believe that banning the largest providers of institutional capital will magically result in the construction of 4.3 million new homes, you need to consult a basic economics textbook and then seek the care of a neurologist immediately.
It's a very cold reminder that in a market completely intoxicated by political narrative, raw math is the only actual medicine available.
It's the only cure.
Yeah.
Look, we've spent this entire time analyzing the pathology of the buyers, the sellers, and the builders who are locked inside this ward, forced to transact under these delusions. But that leaves a massive unaddressed variable sitting just outside the hospital. If the U.S. regulatory environment becomes so hostile, so bogged down in digital vaults and institutional bans, what happens if the massive private equity funds and REITs decide to just permanently discharge themselves? If hundreds of billions in development capital capital permanently pivots to European or Asian markets. Mm-hmm. What happens to the domestic U.S. rental market when the entities that actually build the 500-unit apartment complexes just never come back? Where exactly do the millions of people who are mathematically priced out of buying a home actually live?